Welcome to Sajeev's thesis proposal defense. And Sajeev has been working since 2007 on virtualization related research, and he's done quite a bit of work. We get to hear about all that he's been doing for the past few years. Thanks for coming, especially the committee. Kaushik and Ajay are on the phone. So, I mean, the first part is a presentation by Sajeev, and it's an interactive talk. So feel free to ask questions, and then we'll if you can reserve your question until later, that's better, so we can stick to the schedule. But if there's some clarification that needs to be done, please feel free during the talk. All right, so please get started, Sajeev.
Okay. Thank you, Rudy, for the introduction, and thank you for coming early in the morning. So let's get started. So I will focus on the, as my title says, I will focus on the improving resource management in virtualized data centers using performance models. So as you see that now the virtualization is becoming quite ubiquitous. I mean, everybody is talking about virtualization, right? I mean, industry is talking about virtualization. In the academic research is talking about virtualization. So, and there is a myriad of products and research going on this, in this field. So what I see as a virtualization that it's going in mostly in two directions. So first one direction is that the data centers are becoming virtualized. So before, usually data centers host a bunch of applications. So now what they're doing, that instead of running those applications in a dedicated environment, these applications are now being run inside the virtual machines. And all those virtual machines are together being hosted in a single host. So this is the one trend, like the data centers are being virtualized. What is the another trend is the growth of the cloud service providers. So as you can see in this diagram, typically now if a client wants to host some applications, they don't need to have their own machines in their backyard. So what they can do is that they can just ask for some software or platform or infrastructure from the cloud service provider, and what they just need is that they just need a terminal to get connected to the software or those applications. And the cloud service providers offer those services. Now typically they offer like three kinds of services, the granularity of services. It can be as a platform as a service, which usually offer like a app engine from Google, so that you can develop your own system there. And another is a software as a service, like Salesforce and WatchStream, where they provide the software subscription. And what I will primarily focus on this talk is the infrastructure as a service, where they provide the resource like CPU and memory capacity, and disk and network bandwidth. Now, is it all good? I mean, why people are going towards virtualization? Well, one of the major advantage of having virtualization is that previously we used to have a lot of physical hosts, and those hosts used to be underutilized. So now what the virtualization offers is like you can host many applications in a smaller number of physical nodes. So we are having a lot of savings in terms of physical resources. And savings in terms of physical resources means savings in cost as well. And that cost we have to also include the power as well. And another advantage, which I'm not showing in the slide, another advantage of virtualization is not that people are adopting virtualization just because it saves power. But what people think that if we go towards the virtualized data centers, our management complexity will become less. But is it really the case? Is it really that the management is becoming less complex? Apparently, it is not. I mean, we'll see how management can become complex, and it's quite appalling. So, why is this case? I mean, sometimes the strength which makes virtualization so attractive can be the can potentially be have a negative impact. Why? Because I mean, because the hundreds of virtual machines are running inside a physical node, and all those virtual machines are running into diverse applications. So each application has its own performance need and also own performance, own resource demands. So managing resources to meet the performance of all the applications is not simple. And another is like the virtualization was supposed to be in an isolated environment. Like it was initially thought that all the virtual machines will run in isolation and nobody will have interference with each other. But what we see in practice is not the case. I mean, one virtual machine running inside a physical host can impact another application running inside another virtual machine sharing the same host. Why is that? Because some of the resources are not actually isolated, like the CPU cache or the storage or the network. Those are not completely isolated. So that kind of sharing leads to performance interference. Now, how people deal with that performance interference? I mean, since people don't know, I mean, what is the how much resource it will need in a virtualized environment by an application, what typically the people employ is like data center administrators or clients employ is just pure over provisioning. So what virtualization offers is that we'll save resources, but we see is that we are actually going back to a situation where we are using increased amount of resources. So management is a nightmare. But why is it? I mean, why you cannot have a better management of a virtualized data center? We'll talk about that in a few minutes. So let's look at first, like, what is the typical situation in a typical operation of a data center? Like, it's in this figure, like, they're having several applications running inside three virtual machines, and they're sharing those different types of resources. Now, each application has its own own performance requirements. Let's say the application one says that, okay, I need my transaction per second to be 350. Application two says my response time to be 35 seconds. And application three says, oh, I need my throughput to be 2500 IOPS. As you can see, like each application, even in terms of its performance guarantee, performance metric is quite different. One is offering performance metric as a transaction per second, one is as a response time, and one is as a throughput. And what does data center get in return in offering those performance metrics is like they get a certain amount of revenue in terms of its service level agreement. Like, let's say application one will have $10 per hour, application two will have 20, and application three will have $30 per hour. Now, how the data center will allocate resources to different virtual machines? Ideally, it should allocate the resources, like when you're under the resource constraint, it should allocate the resources in proportion to the revenue that each application is offering. And this is a very simple scenario. I mean, those service level agreements could be quite complex. Like, some application will say that I need a certain amount of minimum performance guarantee. I need my performance to be at least 350, but if you give me more, I'll probably give you more revenue per hour. So administrator is now thinking like, okay, how do I allocate the resources to meet all kinds of challenges? First, it has to guarantee that none of these applications violate its minimum performance requirement, and it has to guarantee on the top of that when it can offer the higher amount of levels of service, so that it allocates resources in proportion to its service level agreement. And this should be ideally done, but this is not the case. And if you don't meet performance requirements of each application, I mean, clients can be really angry and they will make you all those cards worse. Now, this is one scenario.
Quick question. This revenue is the revenue of the data center, right? Not the client hosting the application in the data center.
Clients will say, I want my performance to be 350, and on return of that, I will offer you to $10 per hour.
So the revenue is
for the data center. It's not for the revenue of the client.
Okay.
What is another scenario? Is that it's a cloud. I mean, what is now happening is like you go to Amazon. Let's say Ricardo wants to run an application, and he doesn't want to buy a physical machine. So what you say that you go to Amazon and say, okay, I need certain amount of resources. Give me some virtual machine with certain CPU and memory capacity. But how does Ricardo determine that how much memory capacity or CPU cycle it needs? So clients have to determine that how they do configure the virtual machines. Now, what the cloud service providers typically charge is based on the capacity. So let's say you want to have 1 gigahertz of CPU, you have to pay a certain amount. If you go to 2 gigahertz, you have to probably pay more. But is this the ideal case? I mean, you are just charging based on the capacity. Is there any guarantee on performance? The question is not. I mean, if you go to those websites, they will say, okay, if you need more performance, why don't you just buy a higher amount of CPU? So what clients is trying to figure out, okay, what CPU or memory is actually I need to host my applications? Again, in this case, what typically clients resort to is over-provisioning because they don't want their applications to suffer performance violations. So what I will focus on this talk is that why can't we move from this charging based on the capacity scheme to charging based on the performance scheme? So that we go to Amazon or Rackspace, they will say, okay, you tell me what performance you want. Let's say Ricardo wants 500 transactions per second for a web server, and I will guarantee you. And you pay for the performance you need. Now, in order to achieve the both objectives, first to maximize the revenue revenue in data center, and to configure virtual machines perfectly, we need to understand how all these resources have an effect on the application performance. I mean, let's say how you change from, let's say, a CPU to 1 gigahertz to 2 gigahertz, how much performance difference you are expected to see. So this is very important to realize, to fulfill the objectives I talked about. So performance modeling is a key to enable improved data center management. Now, why is this performance modeling challenging? Why can't we model quickly the effects of resources on the application performance? Well, as we will see in the talk repeatedly, that all these performances have a quite complex effect on the all these resources have quite a complex effect on its performance because it varies in a non-smoothly fashion and it also varies in a non-linear fashion. So it's not easy how do we model the impact of resource on the performance. Plus, as I already talked, that some of the resources are partitionable, like CPU and memory. Some resources are not, like storage bandwidth. So in those cases, we need to somehow encompass the contention that might arise in this shared environment. And all of the solutions, whatever solution I propose, since data center is hosting dissimilar applications, any of the solution I propose, it should be application agnostic, and it should be applicable to any platform. Like it shouldn't be specific to ESX or it should be specific to Zen. It should be in a high level enough so that any platform can adopt that technique. So in view of that, this is my statement that the thesis, like I look to improve the management of data center, virtualized data center, by exploring several techniques for accurate and robust performance modeling of virtualized workloads. And using those performance models, I look at how we can offer a better estimation of CPU and memory requirement of a client in the cloud. And using that performance models, I also look at how a data center administrator can repartition its resources so that the overall revenue it gets from the service level agreement is kind of maximized. So this is the outline of my talk. For the rest of the talk, first I will go briefly talk about the related work on this domain. Then I will talk about the parameters which accurately characterize the performance of an application in virtualized environment. Then I will look into the details of how the performance modeling is done. After that, I will use this performance model to make VM sizing experiments. Again, and then I will talk about how my dynamic resource allocation framework is for configured. And after that, I will talk about the remaining work that still need to be accomplished. So let's get started with the related work. So, I mean, this is not a new field. I mean, people have been looking towards the performance modeling for a long time. First, it has looked at performance modeling in a non-virtualized system. Now they are going towards the performance modeling in a virtualized system. So these are some of the works they focused on. Like in some of the work, they focused on how do you calculate the response time of internet services. I mean, people have used predict response time using some queuing theory. And there is another work which exactly look at what I'm trying to do is that how do you manage the resource in a virtualized server using control theory. And there is a recent work which talk about that when you move your applications to a non-virtualized system to a virtualized system, how the performance interference to make an impact, and how do you model that, and how do you mitigate that to get your service level objective. And another class of works have looked the performance modeling from a different perspective. Those people look at, like, when a crisis happens, how do you handle that? Crisis means when a performance violation happens, you look at the system history, and you also look at the remedy you have. So it's kind of matching, it's kind of automated the troubleshooting. People, some of the works used automated troubleshooting using sophisticated tools such as the Bayesian networks and the logistic regression. Now, how we stand in compared to them is that our focus is not just modeling response time or modeling impact of CPU utilization or modeling the impact of going towards on virtualized to virtualized environment. What we focus is that we are looking to have a performance model which will be able to answer those what if questions. And what are those what if questions? Is like if Leonardo comes up with suggestion like, okay, Leonardo wants to know if I change my memory to 2 gigabytes to 4 gigabytes, what the performance will be. So those are the typical questions our performance model will be able to answer. And what is the difference with other? We specifically deal with the non-linearity. Like some of the works, like okay, in the control theory approaches, like they assume that the performance in a small time granularity can be thought about a linear relationship with the resource allocations. But we'll show in time that it's a very idealistic assumption. Plus, we do not confine our results just on a CPU or memory. We encompass all major types of resources, including CPU, memory, and disk. And these are application agnostic. Now, the VM sizing, usually people looked upon as the VM sizing as the capacity planning in the data center. Like you have a bunch of virtual machines and you have a bunch of physical hosts, and you're trying to identify how you're going to pack those virtual machines onto a physical node. So people looked at the music from the capacity planning of the host, not as a virtual machine itself. What we focus in this work, like we estimate the resource requirement of a virtual machine given its performance level. And there is the dynamic resource allocation. People have looked upon a resource allocation just for a space, either for a specific workload type or for a specific resource type, like for database or for CPU. And also their SLM metric, the service level agreement, they thought is a single level metric. It's just some number. Let's say it's just 1, 2, or 3. So let's say 3 applications with SLM metric 1, 2, and 3. So it's as simple as just allocating resources in proportion to that metric. But in our work, we do not, we think our SLA to be more complex. Like we think SLA as a continuous function of performance and revenue. Okay, so now we'll focus on the parameters which will accurately characterize the application performance and which will act as a control node for our environment. And we'll start with the first. We'll talk about how you go towards selecting those parameters. Like first, it should address all the major types of resources like CPU, memory, and disk. Plus, it should be easy to control and observe. And moreover, it should account for the competition in the shared storage environment or any shared environment from general. Plus, while we select those parameters, we look at in a minimalistic approach. Like we try to keep the number of parameters as minimum as possible, which is kind of very helpful, because when you are allocating resources, you don't have to deal with the exponential number of parameters. And also your modeling complexity grows as you increase your number of parameters. So we try to keep the number of parameters as minimum as possible. And as you've seen in the slide, that with even 3 parameters, we can effectively characterize the application's performance. Plus, the parameters are widely available, and those doesn't need to take into account the application behavior. I'm sorry, the application semantics. So first, we'll start with the CPU. So, in CPU, when you are modeling the CPU behavior, there are mainly two major school of thought. Well, the first school believes that the CPU characterization can be done by modeling the CPU usage pattern or the CPU utilization pattern. And another school of thought is like using the CPU allocation as a control node. But since in our environment, we are mostly looking towards controlling the virtual machines, we are not modeling the CPU utilization, rather we'll focus as the CPU allocation as our control node. And using this theory, we tried our experiments on two hypervisor platforms, one in Rain and one in ESX, and we found that the CPU limit and CPU cap respectively for ESX and Zen are chosen as the control nodes. Now what it does is the CPU limit or CPU cap, it provides an upper limit on the CPU usage of a virtual machine. So far it's good. I mean, I identify the CPU parameter, but what is the impact of this knob on the application's performance? Because that is more important than finding the knob. To do that, what we did is that we picked up several complex workloads and changed our CPU limit from 200 megahertz to 1000 megahertz, and we plot the application performance in the y-axis, and all the performances are normalized. So as we can see, the key takeaway from this graph is that all these applications have different levels of behavior with respect to CPU. I mean, not every even for Ruby's browsing and Ruby's bidding, the difference is quite significant. And another important takeaway from this is that it doesn't behave as a smooth mathematical function. It has different shape-wise characteristics plus non-linear behavior. So as you've seen that like this non-linear behavior will have an impact in the performance modeling, which we'll talk about later. Next is the memory, the same principle we tried out. We didn't talk about that. We didn't think memory utilization would be a good idea. So rather, we focused on memory allocation, and we choose a memory limit, which is available in both brain and in ESX as our control now. And then we plot the same identical type of graphs varying the memory allocation. By the way, in this experiment, the CPU limits were set at a very high level, and also the contention was kind of minimized in the storage. So as we can see, it's the same behavior. Different applications behave in a different way, and plus there is a acute non-linearity in their response to the memory allocation. So now identifying the parameters for storage is not that straightforward, because storage doesn't have like a fixed capacity like all the CPU that memory has. So we need to identify in the storage is not enough that because in storage is not partitionable. So we need to characterize the contention for the storage. So as I already talked, there are some techniques which can prioritize requests for the storage, but this is not enough. We need to somehow encompass the competition in the storage system. Now, what should be a good metric to identify contention in a shared storage environment? This is a very challenging question, and we dealt with several types of metrics. The first we dealt with is the competing IOPS generated by the other virtual machines sharing the same storage environment.
Can you clarify what you mean by IOPS? What does IOPS mean?
The IOPS, right? IOPS means like at any instant, let's say there are five virtual machines.
Just expand the term IOPS.
Oh, it's input output per second. Okay. So we first started with the competing domain IOPS per second, which is just, let's say you have a target virtual machine and you have the other virtual machines running on the same host using the same storage. So what it means is that the competing domain IOPS per second means is that all the IOPS generated by the other virtual machines running inside the same storage environment. And we published a paper on that using competing domain IOPS per second as a storage contention parameter. But later we find out that it has some serious limitations. First of all, you cannot measure competition when your virtual machines are all over the different physical hosts and it's sharing the same storage system. Because to measure the competing IOPS per second, you need explicit communication between the different hosts. Plus, it doesn't identify how the absolute nature of the contention, because your contending IOPS may be random in nature, so it will generate fewer number of IOPS, but your workload is competing with all the random workloads, and you will suffer more performance violation than you will get when you are having high IOPS from the contending virtual machines, but all the contending virtual machines are sequential in nature. Now to deal with that, so we first published the paper with this computer in IOPS per second, but when we later realized that it's not a very good indicator, we tried with the latency as a method. Now latency is an accurate measure of contention. Why? Because it identifies, it takes into account the nature of the contending IO, whether it's sequential, whether it's random, or whether it's it's a high request size or smaller request size, or whether it's random or sequential, the latency would be impacted in either way. So it serves as a better indicator for contention. Now, once we identify our VMIO latency as a parameter, we plot the VMIO latency, we plot the effect of performance by the VMIO latency. So what we did in this experiment is, like, we run our workloads in a virtual machine, and from another virtual machine we ran a random IO generator, and we vary the outstanding IOs to change the level of contention, and we plot the performance in the y-axis. As you can see, it's the same principle, same thing. Different applications have different behavior with IO latency, with changing IO latency. Like, some of the Ruby's profile doesn't have that much of an effect to IO latency or to say a contention, but some of the workloads like FileBench Web Server or FileBench File Server has a huge impact on the changing of latency levels. So again, nonlinearity is the trend.
Could you explain again how you did
that experiment? I mean, what did you vary? Okay, so let's say I'm trying to model Ruby's browsing, the behavior of Ruby's browsing. So I run Ruby's browsing workload in a virtual machine, and I created another virtual machine and ran an IO workload generated from that virtual machine, which is issuing some random read request. And I vary the outstanding IOs issuing from that virtual machine to change the level of contention.
But where do you show, how do you vary that level of outstanding IOs?
I mean, that's not important, because I'm not, but what is important, what is the latency observed by the virtual machine? I mean, I change the level IO and I measure the observed latency by Ruby's browsing and plotted that on the x-axis.
So I guess your argument is that it doesn't matter what the other VMs are doing. What matters is the performance that the VM being modeled is experiencing.
Yeah, the latency.
And that's the latency you have on the x-axis.
Exactly.
Two questions.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the parameters you're choosing to feeder modeling your performance, right?
Uh-huh.
I think the two questions unclear to me is, first one is, are these parameters sufficient, right? For example, if you fix these parameters, the performance doesn't change too much, right? That's the first question. Second question, talk about each of them is nonlinear, okay, change your performance, but each of them is nonlinear. Would that be possible if you take two of them or three of them, their change become, let's say, linear? Would that can happen? Can that
no,
happen?
We didn't see that.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. We didn't see that.
Yeah. So I think it's for completeness, you might want to show that those parameters are sufficient.
Actually, it might even be more complex. Like, for example, memory and IO contention. If you combine it two,
yeah,
it can have more, it can become the more complex behavior,
yeah,
because
yeah,
memory and IO are kind of sort of interdependent among each other.
Yeah, yeah.
So the behavior will get more complicated.
Right, but I think there was another question, which is, are these parameters sufficient
to
completely describe the performance?
Yes.
I think that will be clarified when go towards the model,
okay,
of the performance, like how accurately we can model.
Okay.
So you have some results.
Yes. Okay, so now we'll be moving towards the performance modeling after identifying the parameters. So this is the framework of our performance model. So this is the virtual machine monitor, and that virtual machine monitor is controlling all those resource parameters, the parameters I talked about. And under those resource parameters, it's giving some performance metric values. So what we did is that we changed those parameters, and we collect the application performance metrics under those observed parameters. After we get those values, we feed the data into the performance models. Now, this is kind of a misrepresentation, because each virtual machine will have its own performance model. So after we collect that data, we feed it to a performance model, we build the model, And what the model will do later is that you come up with some questions like, what will be the performance under this amount of CPU, this amount of memory, and this amount of I/O contention? And the performance-led models will be able to answer that question. So this is the basic framework of our modeling environment. Now, what are the basic steps that need to be done to realize the modeling? First, we need to collect sufficient amount of data by varying those parameters. Yes?
I have a question. Why didn't you use the synchro approach of just aggregating resources and aggregating performance?
What do you mean, aggregating resources?
Let's say you have this performance versus resource allocation
mm-hmm.
for two VMs.
Mm-hmm.
If you give this amount of performance to one, this amount of resource to one VM, this amount of resource to one VM, and you just aggregate them and aggregate the performance, you will have the resulting performance of both.
Yeah.
I mean, the question is this because of contention, or why was the reason for doing this?
Doing separate modeling?
Yeah.
Well, it's one way is contention, but how do you know, if you come up with a VM and if you change the allocation of a particular VM, how are you going to know the performance impact of that single virtual machine? You are talking about the collection of virtual machines, the impact of aggregated workloads. But what we are dealing with, we are trying to identify the impact on a specific VM. Because this will be important, because each virtual machine has its own service level agreement. And collectively handling all of them may not be a good idea. And
maybe another way to answer that question is to say that the VMs can change over time. And you may move VMs from one host to the other. You have more flexibility if you have per VM models and you're doing prediction to accommodate all those changes over time.
But this data of a performance versus resource will be the same in any host.
Could be, but the VMs may be different. The applications could be different. The parameters could then become different. But then you have to retrain the model all over again because now you're running with a different set of VMs. Those are some of the limitations. But that's an alternate approach, yes.
But I guess your question is, how are you measuring that performance? I mean, are the performance of two VM propellers, because probably they are both running different applications,
mm-hmm.
and the performance for each of them is different, right?
Yes.
So I guess I have two questions. Well, I have one comment, one question. The first comment is that if they are not comparable, then you cannot add up the performance as Ricardo is saying, right?
Well, it's a very good question, but then why do we model contention in that case, in the first case? Just to identify the impact of having other virtual machines on the same host. I mean, what kind of interference you have when you combine two virtual machines? Maybe the shared storage environment, the contention? So that contention is already modeled as part of our parameter, like VM latency. Let's say these are the two virtual machines. You're trying to say, okay, you model it separately, and you know, under this, if you run it independently, you know what will be the resource performance under certain allocations, but you don't know when you combine it, whether it will still be valid or not, right? That's your question. But since we already model the contention, the impact of latency, as part of the modeling this application. So if you combine another application on the same host or same storage, it will compete with the IOs, but the virtual machine will always observe the latency it's getting, and by that latency you'll be able to identify the performance when you combine those two virtual machines.
Okay. I guess another question I have is, how do you measure performance of each VM? I mean, no, it's not the word I meant. What is the what is the performance of each VM? I mean, it's like, I don't know, transaction per se.
It's the application performance metric. I mean, let's say
application
specific. I mean, it could be response time or it could be transaction per se.
Right.
Or throughput.
Okay.
Now you're varying these resource parameters and you are registering the corresponding performance you get.
Okay, so that's also why you cannot combine them in a single graph, right? As you got over saying.
Yes.
Sarif, I think one thing you should clarify is that one, for each VM there is separate performance market, and that is because each VM could be running different applications. And there is no real need to even compare the application metrics across two VMs. One application could be doing something, others could be producing apples, but that doesn't matter because we are trying to figure out what resources does it take to do a certain application metric. And it is all done independently for the VMs. It can be used independently for the VMs.
Okay. Okay, so these are the stages that need to be done to do the modeling. First, we need to collect the sufficient data, as I showed, by varying those resource parameters. And once you are collect sufficient data, you separate out your data set into two parts. The first part you use for training your model to understand the application behavior under allocations. After you do the training, you try the accuracy of the model with the other data sets, which is, we call it testing. If you get a sufficient accuracy level, like administrator said, okay, I need at most allow 10% prediction errors across a certain data set. If you get your achieved accuracy, you stop. If you fail, you reiterate this process. So you collect more data to make your training more accurate.
And that seems somewhat ad hoc, is that, or is there a more structured process there?
There is a structured the process, but I think if somebody asks questions, I will answer that. It will be too detailed to answer. Okay, so after we have this data collection procedure, how do you model the application performance? Well, we tried with a bunch of techniques. We tried with simpler techniques, we tried with complex techniques. But first, let's start with some simpler techniques, like regression analysis. We tried with the linear regression, we tried with the regression with some quadratic terms involved, and we tried with the regression with pairwise interactive terms. Now, this pairwise interactive terms, why is it important? Because some parameters might have some combined effect, like the memory and I/O latency. That might have some combined effect. Now, to characterize that, we tried with the interactive terms. And on the evolutionary tools side, we tried with sophisticated tools like neural network and also support vector machine regression. Now, what we find with regression analysis is that since those behavior with respect to those parameters are quite complex, a single mathematical model is not enough to capture that behavior, and the accuracy suffers a lot. On the other hand, the evolutionary tools such as neural network or support vector machine, since they are designed to be able to handle those complex situations, in our case, they do it as well. We confirm that by having an experiment, a modeling experiment in a Zen environment in this case. So we tried with all those regression panels and artificial neural network, and we tried with four different kinds of benchmarks. And we registered the prediction errors across a bunch of their testing points. Now, what we'll see from this table is that the errors, all the median error and the 90th percentile errors are quite high in the regression family. But on the other hand, artificial neural network, those errors are quite lower. So that means the neural network is able to model those virtualized applications correctly.
What is the median error? 9%
or? Well, median error 9% means, let's say, because as I told in the previous slide, one, two slides back, like I tried my level of accuracy with some testing data sets. So let's say one workload has 50 testing data sets. So you measure the, you know what is the observed accuracy by running those experiments, mm-hmm. and also you fit it to a model and you get the predicted performances of those 50 data points, mm-hmm. and you get the median out of those prediction errors. Though they are sort of normalized for each point.
So it's just one actually instance, right? The median error is just median of the figure one, right?
Yeah, median is the prediction error of one point which is in the center of the distribution.
So 90% is similar, right? It's lateral one.
90th percentile is the higher errors. So again, that's one point.
Okay.
The missing information here is that all these are percentage values.
Yes.
So each of those is a percentage error number.
Yeah.
To clarify, especially you have three input parameters, right? You just have three parameters, right?
Three parameters.
Yes, it's a pretty simple actually regression, right?
Mm-hmm. But since those behaviors are quite non-uniform, like
mm-hmm.
those curves are completely non-uniform, a single mathematical function is not able to capture all those behaviors.
Okay.
But neural networks, if it can model behavior as a pairwise, like in a small region separately, it is able to characterize that complex behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But is everything is okay? I mean, I tried with artificial neural network and it works, so is everything fine? Apparently it's not the case. I mean, first we tried with the simpler benchmark. But when we move to the complex benchmarks, we see that the prediction accuracy could be really bad. I mean, for example, in these cases, the average and 90th percentile errors across different workloads are quite high, using even a very carefully tuned artificial neural network. And we observe the same behavior even in case of the support vector machine as well. So there's something needs to be done more to handle that kind of workloads. So first, talk about some reasoning. Why is this happening? Why a single NN artificial neural network model has so high percentage errors? Now what we do is that in this experiment we sort the actual output values and we plot the corresponding percentage error of prediction in the y-axis. As you can see in the graph, like most of the higher errors are concentrated on the lower output regions. Like there are some errors which are like more than 200%. So how do we deal with this case? I mean, a better idea would be to model this part separately and model the rest of the part separately. So we exactly did that in our second graph, where we have a separate model for this lower output value region, and we have a separate model for the rest of the parts. And what we observe here is that those errors dropped substantially, even using the same NN models for separate regions.
Well, I don't know if you're going to talk about that later, but what is the model that you use now in the first part?
Artificial neural network.
In both cases? I mean, because you're saying that you're using now two models.
Yeah, the first graph is the artificial neural, one model for the entire output space.
Okay.
And the second graph is the one model for this lower region.
What model is that?
And artificial neural network model.
So they're both artificial neural network?
Neural network, but separately modeled.
I see, and, okay, I see. Because I was thinking, well, if you have a different model in the first part, what happened if you try that model in the second half? Right?
Different models in the first part.
You have two models. One in the first half, from 0 to 40,
mm-hmm.
and one from 40 to 100.
Mm-hmm.
So I was saying that if you have such a low error from 0 to 40, what happens if you try that same model from 40 to 100?
It doesn't work.
Okay. It's actually, if you're using that neural network for like
the difference between two models, right? This is based on different optical values, right? That's what you're doing. What you're
yes.
doing, right?
Why the problem is that since the application output range can span a wider range, like from let's say even in the Ruby browsing, it varies from one request per second to 100 or 120 requests per second. It's very hard for a single model to encapsulate the whole region. So it's probably better like we separate out some regions and model it separately.
But that can't be actually essentially put into one model.
Yes. Yeah, I mean
essentially it's one model, one neural network model actually.
So it's like a decision tree. You
yeah,
either
exactly.
use one
yeah.
The first submodel or the other submodel.
You just add a simply add a layer and then
yes.
get triggered.
Correct.
So the whole of doing these two models or multiple models which you call submodeling is that we reduce the lower accuracy values. We reduce the prediction error values.
Just to back on that question, actually one interesting scenario would be if you're higher region you're using neural network and lower region you're using linear regression, that part make more sense in that combination.
Higher part using...
For example, just like you use different type of model at different region.
I think you did those
yeah.
experiments
okay.
too. Yeah. So you did use linear regression after you breaking up.
Exactly.
You've
okay.
done those.
Yeah. I probably not shown in the slides.
Yeah.
But in the you know my proposal I have shown the.
Can
regression.
You summarize what the findings were then?
I'll talk about when we go into the slides. Okay. So far I talk about that. Okay. Single modeling is not enough. We need multiple models. But the next question is kind of how do we automate this? How do we create multiple models or some models? Well, there is a simpler answer to that. First, the simple question is that why don't you just chop your input parameter space? Let's say you have 0 to 2 gigahertz. Why don't you just chop it to some to 200 megahertz region and create separate models for that? But doing that will increase the number of some models too much. And plus, doing that may not be the inefficient because some applications might have up to plateau just after the 500 megahertz. And beyond 500 megahertz to 2 gigahertz, creating another model is not necessary. So we need more intelligent way to create some models. Now how do you deal with that? We deal with the clustering.
The problem with having too many sub-models is memory or processing time?
It's processing time, that it will become, let's say, because the thing is that it's only we're looking at one dimension. When you go into multiple dimensions, let's say three dimensions having 10, 12 models, that means it's a huge amount of some models to deal with. So it's both processing and memory.
You have to combine all possible submodels across every possible submodel of all resource
parameters. So this is not an efficient way. So we need some more intelligent way to create some models. So that's why what we do is that we use for clustering. In clustering, what we do is that we just feed the output parameter values into a clustering algorithm, and the clustering algorithm determines based on those output range, figures out how many clusters to deal with. And once you get those clusters, you just map your cluster to the input parameter boundaries to figure out, okay, what is the input range of this cluster? We'll talk about that with a nice
essentially, you're building a piecewise model, right? Like a ship.
Yes. So let's start with a simple experiment. This is a Ruby browsing workload. Its entire output parameter space ranges from 6 requests per second to 126 requests per second. So what we deal with that, we feed it to those output values into a clustering algorithm. And in this case, it comes up with two clusters. One cluster where it goes 6 to 24 requests per second, another from 26 to 126 requests per second. So after these two clusters are done by the clustering algorithm, we need to identify how this output maps to the input region, because that is what is important. When you run a query, you don't know the output, but you need to know which submodel to go for while you are coming out with some resource assignment. So the next step is to map these outputs to the input regions. And we figure out, in this case, like it says, okay, so until 0 to 256 megabytes, use the first cluster one, And after the 256 megabytes, any resources element, you go for the cluster 2. Once we get those clusters, we train them separately and create separate models for the two clusters. So when a query comes, it needs to check which cluster it should go to. But let's say in this example, one query comes from for around 240 megabytes, one resource assignment. You should go in this case to submodel 1 to get your results. And if you come, well, let's say 800 megabytes, you should rather go to the submodel 2 with the submodel 2. Now, the interesting thing is that these clusters might overlap. I mean, it may not be completely separated. So how do you deal with that overlapping situation? One way to deal with this overlapping situation is that we look at the how much overlap each cluster, each consecutive cluster has. If there is a sufficient overlap, we either combine those two clusters, or when you run for a query for the boundary regions, we ask both the clusters and get the ensembling of those of the results. So essentially making an average of the predictions across both the clusters. Okay, so this is the chart, like it looks like how, I mean, you do with all those techniques, I mean, what is the effect in terms of prediction accuracy? Can we lower the prediction accuracy? In this case, apparently, you should see, we use support vector machine, which is a support vector machine regression, and artificial neural network. And we should see that across all workloads, your average 98th percentile median error drops quite substantially from using a single model. And another interesting observation, just to answer to Tao-Li's questions, like, since you are doing piecewise modeling, why not use simpler techniques? Why are you doing ANN and SVM again? Why don't you go for linear regression? Well, we tried with linear regression in those piecewise modeling techniques, and still we see that errors are quite higher. It's not in the slide, but in my paper we have the errors are quite high. So even with the piecewise modeling, we need a more evolutionary technique like ANN or SVM. A regression family is not enough. And also we plot the graphs on, what we do is that we plot the actual output values and we plot the predicted values from those two models in for each workload. And you can see from this graph, these are very close. I mean, the predicted values and the actual values are quite close. So we are doing very good in terms of prediction. And those are across the testing points. Those testing points are taken completely randomly. So it's encompassing the whole region and it's completely random and it's completely non-identical to the training data set we used. Okay, so far we talked about the performance modeling and resource parameters. Now, I'll show how the performance model can be used for accurate VM sizing. Now, we talked about the VM sizing before. I mean, what is VM sizing? We need to identify, like a client comes up and say, I need to host this application and I need this level of performance requirement. You figure out what is the CPU and the memory requirement. That we explicitly address with the help of our performance models. Now we'll see some results in the next slide. So what we'll do in this experiment is that this is two workloads we've chosen, Ruby's browser and FileBench web server. And for each workload, we've chosen a randomly chosen target performance values. So let's say for one point, it wants performance to be 50 requests per second. And what those VM sizing algorithm tells, it tells you what is the CPU and memory you need to get that 50 requests per second. So what we did, we feed that 50 requests per second and also a level of VM. In our case, also IO latency is a parameter to that model. So what this sizing algorithm does is just it takes into account the performance model. It takes the input query as the target performance and latency, and it estimates the CPU and memory it needs. And how do you observe that this CPU and memory is enough to get that performance? Is because we run the applications under that major CPU and memory, under that estimated CPU and memory value, and we plot the performance on the y-axis. As you can see, this is the, it's again normalized. I mean, all the target performance you can think of as 1, and all the estimated performance is measured as compared to the target performance. As you can see, that we are at least getting, I'll talk about some another more interesting thing is that about the VM sizing. There are two requirements for VM sizing we look for. First, we need to deliver the performance a client wants, and second, we need to be optimal in our sizing. So we cannot have a very relaxed CPU and memory to deliver that service. So we test both the objectives. So in this experiment, we test whether we are achieving that performance. And as you can see in this graph, that we are actually for both of the workloads. I mean, those are randomly taken target levels. Both files inch web server and Ruby Sprout, you are at least meeting that performance objective. And these CPU values are quite, another interesting observation from this graph is that you cannot just have a fixed CPU value and deal with all kinds of target levels. These CPU values could be widely different. We observe the same behavior in memory as well. Any questions? So next experiment, we measure the optimality. I mean, how optimal is our sizing experiment? Now to deal with that, so let's say, this is for the Ruby's browsing. Let's say you fit a target performance level of 30. You want a target performance of 30 requests per second under a latency of 150 milliseconds, and your VM sizing algorithm tells you, okay, you need probably 400 megahertz of CPU. Now, how do you know it is optimal? So we test with optimality by reducing the 400 to some smaller amount, which we call it delta. In our case, this delta for CPU is 100 megahertz, and delta for memory, which was at 64 megahertz. We chose the optimality as if you reduce from 400 to 300 megahertz, whether we are still getting the same performance. If we still get the same performance, that means we are not optimal. If we have a lower performance, that means we are optimal in the sizes. Now, if we don't get an optimal sizing, we further test how far away are we from the optimal sizing by varying those deltas. So, collecting at 300 megahertz, 200 megahertz, 100 megahertz, and so on. And plot, and in this graph, the lower triangle represents the optimality of CPU, the upper triangle represents the optimality of memory. And as you can see from this graph, that for most of the target performance, our sizings are mostly optimal, except in one of the two cases. And still, it's very close, at least one delta or two delta away, except in one case. So sizings are optimal in our experiments. Any questions?
Do you have any sense for why you're five delta away from the optimal in one case?
I think it has to deal with the modeling error. The modeling tells you that, let's say, you need probably 1500 megahertz of CPU, but in reality, you can have the performance obtained by even running at 1000 megahertz. And the model tells you, okay, in 1000 megahertz, you won't get that expected performance.
So you think if there is a it's because of the inaccuracy of the model.
Is this for CPU or is this for memory? Which resource is it on?
It is CPU.
CPU, okay.
Okay, so we have mostly looked at most of the problems. So I will briefly talk about the dynamic resource allocation. So we just have a framework of dynamic resource allocation. We still don't have any evaluation and actual implementation, so it will be really brief. So what is the typical scenario? Again, the same picture, virtual machines, a bunch of virtual machines running inside a physical host. And each virtual machine, under a particular resource assignment, getting some application performance metrics. And how do you generate the revenues is that each virtual machine is associated with a service level agreement function. So after you get that application performance metric, you feed it to those SLA functions and you calculate the revenue. Now what is our objective? Our objective is that at any instant, let's say you have certain assignments of resources across all virtual machines, and here you know the SLA functions of each virtual machine, and you are getting certain amount of revenue. Now our objective is that how do you allocate the resources so that the total revenue across all the virtual machines is maximized. So this is the objective we envision for the dynamic resource allocation. I mean, different papers, like different research products or software products, deal resource allocation in a different way. In some cases, maybe they just want to maintain the minimum performance guarantee of each application. But in our case, we sort of combine two aspects. We first ensure that each application will have its minimum performance guarantee. Plus, we also deal with that after we ensure that it gets its minimum performance level, how do we allocate the resources so that provision resources so that you get the you deliver higher amount of resources to each applications, and in turn you maximize your revenue. Everyone is comfortable with the framework? Okay. So far we have, I mean, to fulfill these requirements, we need to identify the parameters, which we already did, and we need to model the performance. Why? Because when you're running an algorithm or when you're running a framework, you throw up where you want to change the resource assignment, and you immediately need to know what will be the impact in performance. So for that, we need the application performance modeling, which you already did. Now, we also formalize the problems by incorporating the SLA functions and performance models. And in our case, the SLA is a complex mathematical function. It's not just a single priority value. It's a function of performance versus revenue. So we come up with a greedy heuristic. Now the key takeaway from this greedy heuristic, of course, is that it's the total revenue maximization of all VMs, but another key aspect of greedy heuristic is that we cannot here deal with a complete reallocation of resources. Why is that case? Because since VM latency is a metric for our performance model, and this latency is observed, if we drastically change the resource assignment of those virtual machines, that observed VM latency can alter drastically as well. So we somehow need to contain the alterations of the changing of latency level. Now to do that, we somehow at any instant we restrict our reallocation to some smaller units. So this is a major aspect of this heuristic that you need to, whenever you need to do this dynamic resource allocation, you need to somehow contain it at an iterative level, not a complete drastic level.
The last bullet there, that's your goal, right? You're
that's
claiming
goal.
That your greedy heuristic maximizes total revenue.
Yes.
Its goal is to maximize total revenue.
Yes.
It may or may not end up doing that.
Yes, because of the modeling inaccuracy and everything, but its goal is that.
Arrested.
Okay, so now we'll briefly talk about the future work that still needs to be done. So for sizing, we did some initial experiments, but we still need to explore, like in some cases, the errors are quite high. I mean, why is that case and how do we fix that? And also, we want to evaluate the alternative modeling-based VM sizing approaches. Plus, we just did experiments with two benchmarks. We will also explore additional benchmarks as well. And plus, so far, our sizing dimension is only CPU and memory. We haven't really incorporated VM latency as our sizing dimension. So in future, we want to even ask the optimal VM latency level for the VM as well. Now, so far, one of the reservation in this application performance modeling is that I considered my application behavior to be stable, and so that the number of users in that application is stable, number of the workload mixes in application is stable. But this is not really the case in the online setting or in industry setting. So we need to somehow change our model so that it can work online, it can work in those dynamic environments. So to do that, there are several challenges that need to be identified. First is that we need to characterize the change in the demand level. We need to identify the change in transaction mixes. Then we need to identify the short-lived spikes versus longer, sustained long-lived changes. And the most important thing in online is that how do you collect your training data? Because so far I collect the training data in a separate environment before deploying it. In an identical environment before deploying it. But while you move into an online environment, you need to collect the data in a more efficient way, and it should be quick enough. Now, the dynamic resource allocation, we come up with a good heuristic, but we need to evaluate, and we need to first implement and evaluate using, and explore all the use cases, like what happens when a VM comes into VM is migrated towards the host, or what happens when the demand of the virtual machine changes. So all those use cases will be explored. And this work will actually integrate all the key components, like starting from parameter selection to modeling, and plus the heuristic, and it will test how all the key components work together. So this is the expected timeline I'm thinking. Well, it's a little ambitious, but I think it can be done. And like VM siding is probably the easiest one that can be done very quickly. I'm expecting it January 2012. Performance model online, this is the part I'm still kind of not very confident, to be honest. So, but we'll first look about that. I'm thinking that by March I will fill it. And dynamic resource allocation is, I've already come up with the heuristic, so it's just a matter of how these parts work, like performance models online. Once this is done, that won't be very hard to do. Graduation, I don't know. It's very tentative. October, December, maybe not November.
So if you're done with dynamic resource allocation in May, why do you need so much time to write your thesis?
Oh, because the thing is that I did it, but if I don't publish this work, it's meaningless, quite. So I'm expecting I'll finish it, I'll submit, and I will wait for the reviews and change it in the meantime. So that's why my graduation will be quite longer than the finishing time.
You didn't get accepted, it's another year.
Take another year. So yeah, I think well, we can discuss this later, maybe.
Plus, I need to fight my desire of procrastination, of course. So these are the references I used in the related work section, and this is the list of publications. So the first two are being used for the work. The last one is not related to the work in my proposal.
So can you tell us what those first two papers are about? How do they map to what you did?
Yes, I will talk about the second paper first. So we published an initial work, like some of the experience I showed in brain environment with the smaller workloads with artificial neural network and parameter selection in brain environment. We did that work in that HPCA paper. But later we realized that having a single model is not enough, plus CD IOPS is not, a competing domain IOPS per second is not a better indicator. So to address those challenges, we come up with another which is under submission, and which also addresses the VM sizing, which is in the first paper. So we did our initial work in the second one, but we submitted the improved version on the first one with the VM sizing experiment included.
And so how does your future work map to additional papers?
Future work, I'm thinking that, let's go back to the... So it depends. Dynamic resource allocation will have a separate paper as its own. Not sure about this updating performance models online. If I think it's a substantial work, then it may appear as a separate paper. If we identify, okay, we can do some simple tweaks to make it work, then these two can be combined in a single paper.
So if you combine them, then you will have three papers or four papers, including the one that's not in your thesis.
Yes. And I want to thank all my committee members and collaborators. So some of them have appeared in the two bullets, and I want to thank them for all the help and all the advices they give to me. And plus, I want to thank my lab mates, because these are the friends I work with every day. These are the constant help I get from, like, intellectual help plus emotional help. Like fun, right? And so I'll be happy to take any questions.
Okay, so now we can have questions from anyone. Okay, you have.
Yeah. So Sadiq, what happens if you take your VM and put it in a completely different machine that has a different CPU, a memory at different speed? Will your model still work?
No, you need to model it. Train it.
Model it again.
Separately. You need to model it again, yes. I mean, we haven't talked about the cross-platform prediction yet.
Okay.
There should be another type of dimension to my work. Mm-hmm. But so far, if you move to a non-identical environment, then you have to model it again.
Yeah. And my second question was, so when you're coming up with your research, with your dynamic allocation model, and you have some models and some errors that you got from your testing, right? So those errors might be that you underestimated or that you overestimated. So how would you translate all that into an actual model, saying, okay, if all my error comes from overestimation, then I need to provision for more. If it comes from underestimation, I need to provision for less. How would you, do you have any insight into that?
Well, one of the things we deal with that is, I don't specifically deal with overestimation or okay, overestimation means underestimation is that in the VM sizing experiment, let's say, I mean, modeling can say that, okay, you probably need less amount of CPU, but in reality, you actually need more CPU because it's kind of overestimating. But what we deal with in a situation is like, let's say you have a target performance of 100. Request per second. So we don't really look for 100 per request per second. We actually look for 100 to 10 requests per second, just to make that we at least deliver our target levels.
So you account for a 10% inaccuracy in the model by changing the question,
yes.
Yeah, just to continue on your questions, look at the way of sizing, right? I think one of my students is doing something like aware of VM sizing, because you have over provision and under provision, you know, definitely have different costs, right? So if you look at in the same line, right? If you look at the performance, some of the errors maybe, I don't know, so there's maybe two different types of errors associated with different type of costs. That I think I didn't see any connection between the performance and the cost. Because eventually, if you're a data center service provider, you money, right? Actually, you need to match performance with the money. For example, if your performance, I don't know how to imagine those, honestly, because if you're making a performance guarantee, I have the option of increased CPU, I have the option of giving you more memory, I have the option of giving you more storage, but how these things will, from a service provider perspective, what should I do next?
So you're saying how should the service provider
make use of these
models to come up with a good SLA curve?
Yes, somehow actually manage the resource and their costs, all the things.
Well, this is a good question, Bob. So what you're saying that since you have different types of resources, and each resource has its own cost metric.
Yeah, there's a lot of like one layer. Another layer is you may have different types of errors. For example, looking at the VM sizing, you may have over provisioning, you may have under provisioning.
Mm-hmm.
And different provisioning, you have different costs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first layer. That's different errors, you may have different cost metrics. Second layer is different resources, you may have different costs. So if you're you have costs, you have performance. How these things put everything into a single map, right? I don't know how to fit into the same picture.
Well, the first question is that about the over provisioning and under provisioning,
yes.
The one hurdle is that we really don't need to want, we really shouldn't have under provisioning.
Okay.
Because that's the first thing, like the client shouldn't suffer its performance violations.
But you see that, I mean, over provisioning you get a resource waste, right? If you're under provisioning, you probably just need to sacrifice some waiting time, right? So if you're transfer waiting time and the cost or waste resources, they cannot compare with each other in terms of
I don't look at. Don't look at that. Like if you, let's say, another way to look at that is like, okay, you can have under provisioning. Okay, but the penalty loss is not that much. It's probably less than the cost of over provisioning.
Okay.
We really don't look at those angles, especially in the VM sizing.
Okay.
Right. But I think these are interesting questions. And another related one, which I think we've talked about before, is to look at the distribution of errors in the parameter space. And then based on where errors are higher or which portion of the parameter space errors are higher in your model, you could control your over-provisioning by using that information. Right. So if you see that my model is really accurate in the range of CPU until 1 gigahertz, then there I could be more aggressive with how I size my VMs.
Mm-hmm.
But then beyond 1 gigahertz, my model becomes less accurate, and I'd be more careful in how I size my VMs in that range. Right? So you could do something intelligent in that respect also.
Yeah. That's because actually one of my students is working on right now, so that's why I asked them to come in.
Okay, good. Any other questions?
Ricardo?
Just a little about where do you measure IO latency?
It's at the VM, like from the hypervisor level.
The hypervisor level?
Yeah. So it's a latency reported as a latency observed by the VM itself, not the LAN latency.
No, inside the VM or the
hypervisor?
And the application level could be different?
Could be different, yes.
Why not then?
Because we don't want to intrude on the application VM that much. Our monitoring framework should work from outside.
There is some information you need from the VM, which is the application performance.
I think
it
could report anyway.
It could report elsewhere.
Elsewhere. Yeah. We don't need to go inside the VM to collect it in an actual production setting. But to get into that amount of information, we probably need to go inside the VM.
Could be like a plugin or something that also the VMs run and report elsewhere without allowing the...
That could be, yes. In that case, we can think about that.
Yeah.
I don't know how it happened in Zen, but at least in ESX, you observe that it's almost the latency, difference between the hypervisor and the application is almost like a constant.
Because probably it just sends a request to the without changing anything, without waiting in its own queue. It just, if it gets an IO request, it sends it to the ESX. It probably doesn't block. I don't know.
Is it constant across all the VMs?
Yeah.
Or just within one VM?
It's a number that we solve for many workloads, many VMs,
and every IO?
Yeah.
Within each VM?
Yeah. But it's not pretty large. That's interesting.
But
if it were very small, you would say it's just going through the software stack.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, it's kind of large.
Large meaning like seconds or milliseconds?
No, not milliseconds.
Microseconds.
Well, it is. Well, it's relevant. Okay. When you were doing the analysis of latency, right, you mentioned that you made one VM experience this level of latency by running similar application. Okay, that was a new level of latency in the VM. I mean, typically speaking, seems correct to me that it doesn't really matter what you do with your application to make this VM experience is
no, it combines actually both the effects.
Okay.
It combines both the effects. So latency induced by himself and also latency induced by the others.
Right, but what it means is that we are not interested in how you generate, how you make this VM experience this level of latency. Right. It means that we apply user application doesn't really matter. And it seems to be correct. Could you give more insight why it is correct?
Okay, so I have to stop there because one of our committee members needs to go and we need to do the closed session after this.
I will answer your questions, Swanee.
Yeah, we can take this offline. Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Okay, you have a good excuse, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Right, so I think now we are in the closed session for Ajay and Kaushik. If, you know, let's use this session to give, you know, more pointed feedback, but I'd like to give Professor Tao the opportunity to ask any questions that he might have because he has to leave.
No, I think it's fine, actually. I have some question on your modeling there because I think that the treatment is fine, but I think it can be more formal, like you're doing this. There are two parts there. You're doing this first, doing some model, right? And then you're based on output one space, you're clustering, then you're doing this modeling. So you call some modeling, right? That's one part, and then you claim that you're using. For this part, you're training a neural network. This part, training a non-neural network. I think heuristic. This is very heuristic, right? I think this is more heuristic. It would be better to have a more principle way. Let's put it this way, because essentially, they are just one model. I think if you're using neural here, that can be fitted put into same model. It's like the same as a piecewise linear regression model. It's essentially the same.
Mm.
And also, you're looking at the clustering of out space space. I think that it's fine. Heuristically, it's fine. But somehow, I think it's better if you have a, like I mentioned, principle way to doing this. Because if you're looking at it, you're just doing one dimensional separation of out space, right? That has to be based on the value there. Then you're mapping to input space. So effectively, it's like you're mapping this divided into different regions, right? Because different regions you're mapping to different clusters there. So I think you probably need a more principled way of doing this.
Right. So,
all right.
Do you want to respond to that?
I mean, in my description, I actually described it really well and how
okay.
to automate that process. But what you are essentially looking for is kind of a formal heuristic? Or
yeah.
some proof, like it will
no,
work?
No, no, not proof, because this one is not a proof. So what you can do is, for example, overall you have an object function. Let's put that way for that, if you want to be more concrete. Then actually you have several parameters, you have object functions. Then you can, somehow you have a model actually like, essentially, you are doing a piecewise model. I think that's essentially
yes,
based on
yes,
input.
Exactly.
So you can either train a neural network, you are training a new linear regression. I think you can achieve the similar behavior. So I would like to say something like more principled way. That's probably the best way to put this.
So somehow more systematically.
Yeah, more systematic treatment of this.
Treat the problem.
But right now it's fine. But if you can improve on that direction, would be probably more appealing, I think, theoretically or
you are not very satisfied or convinced with how the the clustering and the
sub-marking. I'm trying to actually a little bit ad hoc.
That's
just what I tweeted. And also, there's a one direction you probably haven't thought about is what I asked during the session is you're looking at different models. There's one scenario is different models probably good for different scenario. Maybe neural network good for small input. Maybe this linear regression is good for large input. So there's a natural question is whether it makes sense to combine them together. Like here piecewise means small input use neural network. A lot of input is linear regression. That's what we mean.
Our modeling framework it doesn't necessarily forces you to use neural networks. So you can use for one piece use neural network for other piece use SVN. Other piece use linear regression.
That kind of ensemble strategy is also very common.
Ensemble strategy, but the framework is very loose. It doesn't restrict you to using neural networks.
Okay, I think that's also the common practice in machine learning literature. Like ensemble different measures together.
But in practice, would it work? Like if an user will use like three modeling techniques to model its application?
Yes. I think that's commonly used.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I can give some pointers. Because one of my students is essentially doing this VM sizing, prediction, VM demand provisioning. They're essentially using the same strategy. They're using ensemble measures combined with linear regression, neural network, and SVM regression.
Okay.
So he's sitting back inside there. So he's doing essentially the same.
Okay.
But it's the context with prediction cloud resource demand that predicts the way I'm sizing. I think that's what he's doing. There's still some interest in IBM sales group.
Okay.
So that's essentially on the same line. I can ask him to talk with you. Maybe you guys can ideas.
Sure.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I think overall, it's very nice framework. The kind of performance when you know, once you have a performance model, you can enable you doing different actual strategies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you have a format to sign now.
Do you have the form, or I can sign later?
Later, because it's already there, the deadline has passed, so
okay.
I have to submit.
Okay, I have to go first.
Thank you.
First. Okay.
Thanks for coming. Okay, so any other feedback or suggestions for Sajid?
Ajay Kwashikar?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can use this. We all know about this work, right? So we can use this time maybe to give some feedback on the presentation itself. I mean, on style and or
could have been better, I know.
Slide any more pointed feedback on presentation skills, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I do come in to give us a lot of interest. We have done a lot of things to come together. So I think I guess some of that. Only thing in terms of the presentation is the putting too much, the text will say too many things probably. And that may confuse some of the audience. That's my feeling. Normally, I try to speak as little as possible to speak in the presentation.
You mean speak lesser in our...
But conclusive, by the way.
Yeah, speak more way because you're giving too much details and too much details and you talk too much. At least that's why I do the presentation. If you give too much details in the presentation, nothing gets into the head of the audience. So just stay on the high level. If someone wants to get into the deep, he can hear, she can talk about offline or to look at the paper.
So Kaushik, can I summarize by saying that the descriptions were a bit too elaborate or verbose in the slides?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ajay, do you have any feedback on presentation?
I think the slides were pretty good. I was quite impressed, and I think Ajay did a good job in terms of making the slides and presenting the ideas and animation. I think overall slides are good. I feedback is sort of around feature work. But we can discuss it, I think, later as we go over that.
Okay. Yeah, if you have any high-level, maybe a couple of lines along those lines, you could inform us right now. I think this is an appropriate time to do that.
The other comment I have, and I think you may have some different opinion on that, and people don't say that, but I think at this point of Sunil's career, probably looking at the N plus one game is not a bad idea. So maybe you can try to think in that direction, how to increase his count. Because
actually
the job market
sometimes
matters.
Oh, you mean paper count?
Yeah.
I think
the eight plus one game doesn't work for us, but this is the senior level, at this level probably it's valuable.
Okay, by N plus one, let me clarify, you mean like adding another paper to the set of N papers? Is that what?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's trying to say that your N is your N is too high and my N is too low. In my case, it matters N plus one.
Well, I think I agree with that, actually. I do not have a different opinion. I agree with your opinion. I think as long as each paper makes sense, right, it's okay to have more papers. Each paper, in my opinion, should have sufficient merit to stand on its own. What I don't like is when people try to create papers artificially, right? But I think in your case that you have enough material to, instead of having, I think you mentioned two papers or one paper, I don't know, one more paper, right?
One more paper at least, of course.
One more paper. I think it could easily be two papers.
It depends. I'm not sure. I'm not still confident about the modeling online. So I need to see how much work still needs to be done on that area.
Right, and two plus one may be challenging. So, yes.
Yeah, so the way I was thinking of maybe whatever you're thinking is correct, and what you can another way you can think of is that all this work that you do is tied up to the same question particular problem. So if you can you have a bigger paper like targeting in a prestigious journal kind of thing, so the base limit is not that much issue.
Okay, I think that's good feedback. I think we should certainly explore the possibility of having maybe one more paper beyond that additional paper.
What we can really do is that if we have a sufficient work on online model, but it's not enough to sustain as a single paper, what you can do, we can combine all the modeling work into its journal version. With the inclusion of online.
And based on some of the feedback today, it seems even the sizing problem could be more
complex.
Yeah.
So even sizing can be sold as a single entity.
Yeah.
If it's a lot of work.
Possibly.
Yeah. So we probably need to spend a lot of effort on the online part.
Yeah.
If you right now the work we have,
especially for our framework, if you want to to change it to online, probably needs a lot of more work. Because in some cases we're using control theory, all those cases, it's like an automatic online nature of those kind of modeling behaviors.
So to give you yourself a competitive edge, job market, no matter where you want to go, I feel what you have done probably from one third to half. I think there's still a lot of things you need to work on, but hopefully it does faster.
I think your comment is mostly based on the number of papers, right?
Not just number of papers, but the amount of work. As the, we have really, just to say how we have really been really successful, I guess. So far we have done just static modeling and then static results sizing.
One third to half, that's a little bit of a concerning. I mean, I'm not saying that you're not right, but I think that's a little bit of concern because your timeline doesn't reflect that.
Your timeline
but
says.
Thing is that the initial work is too I mean, it's kind of more challenging, I think, than the other parts, by the resource allocation of those parts.
So you're arguing that, well, although one third to half maybe.
Yeah,
two,
I mean,
but
it's like building a house. Like, I mean, you need more time on the bed rather than going from two stores to five stores. So I think we did, because what we realized is that even the static modeling is not very easy. People haven't looked at it in that way, but they just sort of avoided it and tried to build a more complete system without fixing those small details. But what we figured out is not that very easy work if we target a specific specific modeling problem.
I think I agree with that. I think you're right that the foundational aspects of the work took us quite a bit of time. But moving forward, and I hope, you know, your prediction is right that we'll use lesser time to complete some of these new papers.
I think another aspect is that because this modeling work is kind of moving around in different conferences, so if it gets published, probably it will help the next steps go a lot quicker, a more accelerated way.
Right.
Okay.
Where is the reasonable comeback for this paper?
It's we'll get a rebuttal on this weekend around.
Okay.
So based on the rebuttal, probably we can guess.
So we get reviews and then we have to send them a rebuttal.
Yeah.
To the reviews. Okay.
And the actual decision is by 20th of this month.
Okay. So
shall
we write future work? I think one of my concerns is when you start updating performance models online, is it mostly updating or is it also creating them online?
I think it's both.
It's both.
It's both?
Yeah.
And that you're saying it's a 3-month project that you have pushed from January to March?
Yeah.
That's what the timeline shows, I guess.
And I think that seems like a one, it's how much do we have there? Do you have a concrete idea of how you would create it online or how much exploration is needed there?
That's the part I told you, like, I'm not that very confident on that issue, on that subject.
Yeah, I think what Ajay is trying to say that this might turn out to be a much more elongated piece of work than you imagine right now.
Yeah, and another way, like, to go for quick publishing is that if we have our modeling paper published, so what you can do is that instead of looking at the dynamic modeling problems, because since it's still unclear to me, so we can directly go for the dynamic resource allocation. Not the dynamic resource allocation, but resource allocation with the revenue maximization objective, with considering the static workload behavior.
Right, the only concern I have there is that some people might question the assumption that the workload is static, right? Especially if you're talking about dynamic changes and you're arguing, okay, this is something that will happen over a longer period of time and in each iteration we're going to make small changes. People may have some, and I'm more concerned about the paper getting short because of this, some basic disagreement.
So you're saying the reviewers might say, okay, this is too idealistic, just. But
it's all a matter of who reviews it, I think. I think some reviewers might think that's a big weakness, right, that you're assuming that the workload is static and doing all these dynamic changes. I mean, to be absolutely safe, I think we should first do the online modeling. But I do also agree that could be, I mean, with Ajay, that could take a long time. And
I mean, it's one thing to say that you would update the model online, and it's another thing to say that the whole model would be built from scratch online.
Okay.
And actually, one is relatively harder than the other. Building from scratch is much harder than trying to do some update if there is a performance difference.
Yes.
Okay. I think that sounds reasonable to me. So you're saying construct it offline and then use it and just update it as necessary, as things change. Awesome. Yeah, that may be a middle ground.
Online is a full project in itself. Saying that you would build it from scratch online, I think that's a project, and 2 months is very short for that project.
Hmm. Okay. So, well, I think what you are suggesting then is to change the plan a little bit and for the online modeling work, just to restrict it to updating the model and to and not to construct it online.
Well,
that's fine with me.
It's one possibility. But you have to think of your use case for that. What that they have to use.
Yeah.
I think you should not try to just meet your proposed timeline. Just try to make sure you have enough amount of work through the budget. And if it takes more than a year, we have to graduate in 2003, then I think it's worth it.
I'll try to push next year, probably, because I'm targeting to publish an OSDI,
uh-huh.
A conclusive work on revenue.
I know, actually, you may be very anxious.
I'm trying to now push on, it's getting a little late.
But as I said, you did enough time. Okay, so even if you're lucky, you can get papers published without substantial differences among the papers. This may not be good enough. To
job. I think the committee has to agree that the proposed work is sufficiently deep and broad at the same time. And so that's, I think that's a discussion we can have after sitting here. So.
Yeah, the item proposed there is okay, but I think now we are talking about how to change it so that we can graduate next year. I don't like that feeling.
Hmm.
I don't understand saying that we cannot shrink the amount of work that you need to do so that you can graduate. And that may not give you materials for the time.
I think that's a valid concern, right. So we should discuss it definitely. Any other feedback for Sajid? Okay, so Sajid, if you want to leave the room and then I'll come find you. Wherever you want.
Oh, okay, so I'll leave it.
Okay, wait. Don't leave anything. You might want to take that.
No, because they're online beginning.
Oh.
They're a closed room, right?
Okay. I'll be back.
So you'll be in the lab?
I'll be in the lab, so once you guys come back, I'll be.
Okay. Okay, I'll stop by the lab after we are done.
Okay, sure.
Okay, so for me, I think that given Sajid has one paper, or actually two papers, the first paper was not really discussed in the proposal and he was not the first author, mostly helping Kaushik and me to do some experiments and so on, but the HPCA paper and this new VEE submission, I think those count as two papers. And ideally, I would like, another two papers, which I think can be done given the proposed work. So I'm going to try and push him to do that. For me, if there are two additional substantial papers, that's good enough. And as far as I'm concerned, even if these two papers come after we change the goal to, just updating models online, I think I'm fine with that. But I know that Ming has an issue with that.
I think it's okay if we can find that. If we can make an argument for that.
Yeah.
It will be okay. Yeah. But I cannot...
My concern, yeah. I mean, I agree with Ajay, because constructing a model online and updating it online, maybe a lot more work than we think it is. So, my concern is that if we send off Sajid to do or pursue a goal that may take another 2 years, I don't think it's really fair. Because he's done a lot of work. Yes, he's not been as successful maybe in some of the work, but I mean, given that he's already spent almost 5 years here. And given that, he's eager to graduate, he's just going to get frustrated if we say, okay, spend another 2 or 3 years here, right? So I don't want that for him or for myself. I don't want to be advising someone who doesn't want to be here, right? But yeah, at the same time, we have, I'm not saying that we should just let him off easily. I mean, I think that,
my opinion at least, he's done some reasonable work. And if he does those two additional papers, I think, at least for me, it's...
He can pass, I agree.
Yeah, or even if, I mean, like I said in some other instances, getting papers published in top-tier conferences is a, you know, unpredictable proposition. So even if the paper is complete, as far as, and we agree that it's good enough, and it's submitted somewhere, right?
I mean,
that's okay with me.
I think my main concern is probably may not be that easy to even considering just updating models online.
It may be difficult too.
Yeah, but what would be the assumption, right? We need to, the assumption has to be realistic. So right now I cannot think of a reasonable assumption of that. It's just like without online modeling, there's no way to do, you know, realistic dynamic resource allocation. So I don't know, So it turns out to be more difficult than what we expect. But certainly we can discuss that later.
What is currently on the plate? If one does a good project on creating the models online rather than offline and just finish there, I think that's substantial work in itself.
Right.
If one says that seems like a hard problem, let's go towards revenue maximization. And as part of revenue maximization, we can do updates of model if there is requirement for that. Then that itself, I think, is substantial. I think on any one of these two, if there is a good paper, I think that plus this previous papers, I think it makes a pretty good contribution. And I feel that aiming to do both of them and putting that as a condition seems a little too high.
Yeah, I have the same sense as Ajay. I feel like if you push him to do online modeling, creation and updating, I mean, and the another paper on revenue maximization, and doing everything well, I think that might take longer than a year easily, or even a year and a half.
Yeah, so the question is, if we agree to this overall hypothesis, then the question is, should I do make it explicit saying that work on one of these two projects and he can pick which project he wants to work on and we call it quits there, or should we let him work in parallel on both and then later on based on the success we choose?
I like the latter option because, given experience with the projects that Sajeev has been involved in, they've changed courses many times. So if we keep our options open in the beginning and then later on fine-tune it and pick one, I would be happy with that.
Yeah. It does not have to be decided now.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that seems fair to me. That we say that these are the problems to work on. And he can work on both of them, and as we get more clarity and more data and results, we can choose. And I think at that point, whenever we are satisfied with either one of the contributions being ready for publication, we know that it's, the requirement is fulfilled at least.
Okay. Is there agreement on this thought and this point?
Yeah, I agree on that, but I just wanted to add something. Personally, I believe just professional his career, it may not be a good idea just to rescue or target and complete a conferences if it doesn't succeed. Because I really believe that at this point, some N plus one, some incremental conference will run down for this mission material than having nothing on its list.
So Kaushik, I think your suggestion is okay. Let's say that one paper is keep getting sent back from the top tier conferences, it may be a better idea for him to publish it in some journal, to have it in the record in his resume, than to have it floating around at the point that he graduates.
Yeah, because I where he gets it, I think he should should have actually at least 3 papers on his plate.
Okay.
Otherwise,
I think that is something that at the time of publication, I think everybody, including Sajid, we would decide if something is going to make it into top tier. Sajid thinks it's not going to make it into top tier. I think most people would be willing to send it to wherever there is a good chance.
Yeah.
But just to handle the particular concern of number of papers, do we know what Sajid is targeting after graduation?
I don't quite know. I haven't had that discussion with him yet. So, but yeah, it's about time I should talk to him about what his plans are for the future.
Yes, I think part of that decision would also depend on where he is planning to go and how critical the number of publications.
That's true. I agree. Okay, so I mean, I'm assuming that we're going to let him pass the proposal exam and move on to the dissertation phase, right?
Just have a discussion with him on his future plan and his publication. I'll certainly do that as soon as I can.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for especially Kaushik for staying up late in Singapore. What's the time there? Like 2 a.m. or something?
1 a.m. But it's pretty normal for me nowadays.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot again, and to Ajay for waking up earlier than his usual time.
It's fine. I already had to cut something.
All right. So, well, I guess we'll meet again soon with Sajib, maybe next week, or I think we haven't met for all these weeks because he was busy writing his proposal.
Yeah.
So, but now that he's done with this, we can meet again.
Okay.
All right. See you guys.